Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Michigan Literary Network Radio. It's Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. I'm Andrea Daniel, and today my guest is Herb Boyd, whose new book is Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. And here's a little bit about Mr. Boyd. Herb Boyd is a journalist, activist, teacher, and has authored or edited 22 books, including his most recent one, Civil Rights, Yesterday and Today. His book, Baldwin's Harlem, a biography of James Baldwin, was a finalist for a 2009 NAACP Image Award. In 1995, with Robert Allen, he was a recipient of an American Book Award for Brother Man, The Odyssey of Black Men in America, an anthology. We Shall Overcome, a media fusion book with narration by the late Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, is used in classrooms all over the world, and is, as is his autobiography of A People and the Harlem Reader. His articles can be found in such publications as The Black Scholar, The Final Call, The Amsterdam News, Cineast, Downbeat, and the New Journal, the Network Journal, among others. And I want to welcome Herb Boyd to Michigan Literary Network Radio. Hello, Mr. Boyd.
Hey, Andrea, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good, good, good. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. So let's talk about this timely book. I'm loving it. I'm loving what I'm reading so far. And so of all the books you could have written and released, why was this the book for now?
You know, it's always amazing how these projects come to me. It was not my idea to begin with, but that's usually the case with almost half the books that I put together was somebody else's idea. And they figure, well, maybe you can pull it off because of your experience and the general kind of expertise and passion that I can bring to a particular topic. And I always feel absolutely blessed that I'm chosen, you know, for some of these assignments. And that's true for Brother Man. And like you mentioned, in 1995, you know, winning the American Book Award, that was one that was brought to me by an editor. My agent has brought me at least four or five major projects, and she was responsible for Black Detroit as well. So what I'm saying is that sometimes, you know, you can be in this business, and if you're doing very well out there and you get some attention, because editors, they like someone who can turn a project around, meet their deadlines, and complete it with a certain amount of excellence. So I think they have put a certain kind of faith in me in carrying on these projects. And, of course, I have lived in Detroit long enough to know where all the bodies are buried.
Right. Right. So was it that particular point or something else that sparked your interest when the idea was given to you by your publisher, by someone else? What was it that made you go, yeah, I can write this book. I want to do this.
Well, think about it. I certainly did. I had thought about it over the years, but, you know, you think about doing a particular project and then something will come along and it's a little bit more substantive. It's right there. You can grab it and do it, and someone else is interested in doing it. It's always nice when that happens, a certain kind of serendipity, you might say. But anyway, hey, given that opportunity, I jumped on it. And, of course, you know, you draw on a lot of the emotional and personal experiences that you had. At the same time, you know, it requires a certain amount of digging in, you know, going to the repositories and doing the archives and the museums and the libraries and interviews and stuff like that. So it's an accumulation of information and data that you can finally have to refine it and then polish it and perfect it. And, of course, you can do that with your editors, with your agent, and, of course, with my wife, who is my in-house editor. So with all of these, this great team that I have, you know, it was just a labor of love for me.
Right. Okay. So I'm glad you mentioned the personal aspect of it for you, having lived in Detroit. You live on the East Coast now?
I live in Harlem now.
in Harlem. Okay. Ooh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a whole other subject in and of itself.
Right.
Harlem.
Yes, indeed.
From what I've been reading, but mm-hmm. but the personal aspect of it, because you and your family were part of the Great Migration, moving from Alabama in the South to Detroit in 1943. And I must say that your description of your move in the book's intro is really moving. I mean, I could see it in my head as I was reading it. But how did being part of that kind of move for you inform your writing for this book, if at all?
It was like a moment of recall, of just kind of transporting yourself back to those days and try to capture the kind of, you know, the surprise. You're coming out of a cotton field. You're coming out of a peanut patch, and suddenly you're thrown into this here very vibrant and exciting urban scene. I can remember, you know, when the bus was driving through downtown Detroit and to see, like, the Fox Theater and to see the marquee there, you know, with all the bulbs blinking and everything. It was just like, I had never seen anything. It was like all the stars had gathered in one place. And I was just, you know, the cars zooming by and the streetcars and the buses, all of the noise and the certain kind of rhythm of the city. I came alive, you know. It was just like such an exciting experience for me. So when they do it, kind of recalling that, you know, it was just a matter of kind of getting into that mood and attitude. And let's say transport yourself back to those moments. What did you really feel? You know, what was that excitement all about? And you try to capture that particular moment. And then you add to it, you know, you do your research and everything, and you talk to people. I had conversations with my mother about a lot of these things, and so she helped me and guide me in such a way because, you know, she was a young woman when she did her reconnaissance trips, you know, coming to Detroit in her early 20s, so she knew the lay of the land, and she prepared me and my brother for what we were going to experience up there. And moving into Detroit, we bounced around that city quite a bit, and that's part of the stuff that I kind of recall and recount, you know, in Black Detroit, you know, moving from neighborhood to neighborhood and meeting all these very interesting people who later would be outstanding and very important personalities in Detroit's history.
Exactly. And that's one of the benefits, I guess, you got from moving around so much.
Right. You have all these contacts. And, of course, whenever I did that, I always brought, you know, if you leave, some people move from a neighborhood and they leave all that behind them. But I kind of drag that stuff right along with me. You know, some of the people that I meet, the stories that I hear. And I was always very good about listening to people's stories. And a lot of those stories are recounted again in the book. You know, it's just might kind of dredge them up, you know, dig into my memory bank and come up to, what did so-and-so say to you at that time? And what was their experiences all about? Because it's more than my story. You know, it's a story of a people and the kind of challenges that they face, you know, from one generation to another and how they overcome. And so what I'm trying to capture in as you move episodically, you know, from 1701 all the way down to the bankruptcy, you know, that's a long stretch of history, isn't it?
It is. And one of the things, I mean, you mentioned a little bit of it, but one of the things I want to pull out is the goal that you had for this book, because you do touch on many areas in the book. You got 29 chapters in the book, and you start a long way back. So, and it's a book that feels like a complete history of not just life in Detroit, but specifically Black life in Detroit. What was the goal that you were trying to get to?
I think one of the things, the mission, this odyssey, was not only to tell the stories, but also, you know, the African-American presence in Detroit is almost like emblematic. It's kind of a microcosm, also a Black America, because Detroit becomes like the kind of a blueprint, a model city in so many ways, you know, for the African-American presence there. And one of the joys of all that is that you have like the automobile industry in which Black workers were like at the point of production there. And of course, when you look at the situation with the culture and whether it's literary, whether it's dance and whether it's music and the role of African Americans, all of that. So I think one of the goals I had in mind was how you begin to kind of contextualize and weave all these different elements together so you see a full tableau, a full tapestry of the black experience in urban America. And so it becomes like a prototype, you know, for, I would hope, other cities and other writers and historians would do the same for their particular neighborhoods and cities as I've done for Detroit, because we need to put all these things together to get a full understanding of the African-American experience in America.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you now, if you're able to, if you got the book by your side, can you read a short excerpt from it?
Okay, sure thing. I will read, I don't know how far you've gone in the book, Andrea, but is there anything that you would like to hear, or is, you just want me to select something?
If you select something, I think that would be good.
Okay, why not we turn to the end of the book, maybe just before we get into the right after the afterword,
mm-hmm.
where we have like a son remembers.
Okay.
Okay, and it reads like this, Andrea. So here and there, throughout Black Detroit, I've mentioned Catherine Brown. And that is my personal pride because she is my mother. Now, you can go to the index and see how she is inextricably woven into the narrative. I could not have done this book without her sharing her story, her memories with me. And what a memory. Only on a couple of occasions did we differ, mainly in counting the number of places where we lived in this city. I deliberately refrained from including every little historical incident in which she was present or which she vividly recalled. However, I found it impossible to exclude my deepest impressions of her when I was four and she brought my brother Charles and me from Alabama to Detroit, just in time for me to experience the race riot of 1943. From her early reconnaissance trips to Detroit, before moving here, down to her apartment at LaBelle Towers in Highland Park, most of her 96 years have been in her beloved Detroit. I think I was about 5 or 6 when I began badgering her with questions about my father, asking why he wasn't with us in Detroit. It took me years to unravel that she and my father had different views about how and where the children should be raised. As a farmer, my father was a man of the soil, and my mother, she was a dreamer and wanted something more than the limitations of Jim Crow. She had only an 8th grade education, but my mother was extremely resourceful. During World War II, she was among the fortunate few black women to gain employment in the arsenal of democracy. When that ended, I remember the succeeding years when she would leave the house at the break of day and return as the sun went down. It took a full day for her to travel to the suburbs and then come home after her job as a domestic was done. Her native abilities were phenomenal, stuff no classroom could have ever taught her. She shared these things with me, teaching me to read and to write, to prepare my breakfast, to handle her precious shellac records. She was the best bidwhist partner I've ever had. Imbued with these lessons of life, I was never without confidence and never without her encouragement to excel. When I was 19, she managed a kitchen at Hall's Department Store on Schoolcraft in Wyoming. It wasn't long before she convinced the owner to give me a job chasing stock and working in the warehouse. But neither of us lasted very long at the store, and soon she was back doing her day work. Because of the thorough way she cleaned the house, she always was in demand in the suburbs, primarily working in Jewish homes, where she learned their culture and taught me a smattering of Yiddish. She acquired additional familiarity with Jewish rites and rituals, which, with her many years working at the kitchens at Sherry Zadak, one of the nation's largest synagogues. How's that?
That's great. That's such a, it's a wonderful dedication and a wonderful depiction of your mother. And I just, that is just beautiful. And this is Michigan Literary Network Radio with my guest, Herb Boyd. He just read a beautiful excerpt from his book, Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. And I can see how you had to weave your mom throughout the book. She gave you such a good history and such a good experience to bounce off of.
Oh, yeah, you know, she's 97 years old and just as sharp as ever. And I'll be seeing her, you know, tomorrow we leave New York for Detroit. And it's kind of the beginning of the book tour. We launch it out there in Detroit, rightly enough, you know, at the Wright Museum. And from there, well, we move across the country. And certainly here in New York, we're going to have a major launch of the publication. But I'm hoping that, you know, that I've done her some service, you know, and I've been fairly accurate and honest in talking about her experiences. Of course, I'm going to have these discussions with her because she's going to challenge me on some of this stuff, and that's part of our relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what I found interesting, too, is that you gave story and voice to some lesser-known Detroiters like abolitionist William Lambert and Renoma Gordy Singleton, Berry Gordy Jr.'s second wife. Why were these people and others like them, you know, some of the lesser-knowns, important for you to include in the book?
I think one of the things about it, if you're going to get a people's history down right, you have to go to the origins. You have to look at the seminal aspects, the foundation. You know, where is that basic beginning? And the basic beginning for black people in Detroit is that, you know, is the Underground Railroad. Because, you know, as we look at it later through the years, when you look at my life and you look at the great boxer Joe Louis, you look at the first black mayor in Detroit, all of us came out of Alabama. And if you look at the map then, Andrea, you'll see this is a straight line migration. You know, it's almost going straight up north, you know, from Alabama, and you go straight to Detroit. Of course, as you go further to the west, you're going up the Mississippi River, you probably end up in Chicago. So Chicago and Detroit were great terminals, you know, for the Underground Railroad in what you call the western part of the country. Of course, along the eastern seaboard, people left Florida, Georgia, and they went up to, like, Washington, D.C., or on to Philadelphia or New York City. That's a kind of a straight line for them. So many African-American people in the 1920s, when Henry Ford put out that $5 a day announcement, it was like a flood of people, you know, finding their way any way they could, following the Underground Railroad, more or less, the same kind of pipeline that their ancestors used running away from slavery. And a lot of people don't understand that slavery existed in Detroit at that time. So anyway, that's the beginning. And William Lambert, he was a conductor on this Underground Railroad. And he was there, particularly in the 1850s, when you had the Fugitive Slave Act, when you had to go a little bit further and do a little bit better. People thought that he got to Chicago or got to Detroit, they had got to the promised land. But it was not exactly that, particularly with bounty hunters out there, you know, and they grab off anybody off the street and you don't have your papers, whether you had your papers or not. They could grab you and throw you right back into bondage. So William Lambert was in a position to help people navigate their way around the city and, if need be, help you get across the Detroit River into Canada. And even when you got to Canada, they found they had to go a little bit further, right on up where now Highway 401 would take you all the way to Toronto or up to Chatham, Ontario. They figured the further they can get away from the reach of these bounty hunters, the better. So that's the beginning. You have to start with that beginning. And William Lambert and George D. Baptiste and Madison Lightfoot and William Webb, these are some of the early pioneers in the history of Detroit. So their stories is almost, you know, inextricably connected with the evolution of the city itself.
Absolutely. And thank you for that wonderful history. And so one thing about the book, it just doesn't live in and glorify the past, although it does a wonderful job of doing that. But you talk about current life in Detroit today, as you refer to it in the intro, about as Bright Horizons, where you mentioned Malik Yakini's Detroit Black Community Food Bank Food Security Network and the Motor City Match Program, and you also mentioned the discussions of Black Studies at Wayne State University. Mm. So what is it that strikes you about Detroit these days?
Well, one of the things about this is that when you see the early years and see this year struggle for self-determination from generation to generation and the kind of achievements and the obstacles that was placed in front of us in terms of housing and employment, you know, the whole question of, you know, hanging on and getting a good education, all of that, you know, was a part of this year particular odyssey, you know, that African Americans had to go through in order to make any kind of achievements. So one of the things you want to do with that is to make sure that if you're looking back, and past is prologue for me, when you look back and you see some elements there, in other words, the old expression, the more things change, the more they remain the same, because now we have some more challenges facing, even today, you know, everything is not rosy in Detroit, as you know so well. There's so much to be done there, so much to overcome, you know, still some obstacles in front of us, challenges that we face as a people there. And now you're talking about a city that is like 85% to 90% Black. And so you're facing with a situation where the revenue has been depleted. It's not like it used to be. The whole the industry is not there like the automobile industry used to be, the real lifeblood, you know, of the city. That's no longer there in any really substantive way. And then you say, okay, well, what kind of manufacturing base do you have? Because you need that in order to get your tax revenues. You need to have the people there in order to tax them to gain revenue to keep your city alive. So it suffered in that sense. That's why the bankruptcy, and then, of course, you have the other kind of negative aspects in terms of corruption and inefficiency and poor management and what have you. All those things add to the inadequacy of getting the kind of leadership and the kind of development, growth and development that every city needs. And so there's a struggle to get back to some of those glorious moments in the past, you know, when we faced those obstacles and defeated them and got past restricted covenants, which had us limited and circumscribed in the black bottom in Paradise Valley, and began to stretch out and move into other parts of the city. And so now the city, the 139 square miles of the city of Detroit, is populated for the most part by African Americans. So they have that obligation now to grab on to the legacy of the past, renew it, rejuvenate it, and make it applicable for the moment as it was in the past.
Right. So would you, with that being said, it sounds like there's something that can be learned from the book that can serve as a guide to Black Detroiters today.
Exactly. I think that there's a certain blueprint there and certain lessons. All books have certain lessons if you can distill. And sometimes you have to read between the lines, but you don't have to do that hard in Black Detroit to see where the message, you know, leaps from the page, where you begin to look at the kind of cultural, the denizens that we had on the cultural front there. When you could have the magnitude of the visionary aspects of a Dudley Randall, for example, at Broadside Press, you know, and suddenly, you know, people picked up on the idea of an African-American owning his own publishing company, that was a phenomenal development. That was a tremendous leap. So he had others like a Hakeem Adabuti in Chicago, or Paul Coates with Black Classic Press, or Casahun Chicole, who has a Red Sea Press. All of them saw the stimulus and got the influence from a Dudley Randall and his the kind of independent outlook that he had in putting together his press there at the same way that Berry Gordy did in the music industry. So whether you look at it from the literary standpoint or the education front, we had the kind of legal giants and geniuses, the Dana Keefs, the Wade McCrees, the Kenny Cockrells, all of them, you know, gave us kind of a jurisprudence base there that was just absolutely incomparable. And many people picked up on that from one city, from one African-American community to another, began to look to Detroit as being kind of exemplary in terms of what they can do in terms of progress and growth and development.
Right, right, right. And oh my goodness, we are winding down our time, and I want people to know that they can continue this discussion and continue hearing more about this book on Saturday. You've got a book signing, you mentioned earlier, and a discussion at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History this Saturday the 10th. It's at 2 o'clock. And someone, who's on the program with you?
I have Dr. Rita Ndozi. Rita and I, we work together, call her Kiki, too, and she's at Michigan State University, and we work together on a book on Malcolm X called Malcolm X in Michigan. And even before that, you know, we've been involved in a number of other, she invited me to the college to speak there. So I gave her, I say, hey, you wanted me, now I want you. So she'll be in conversation with me. She'll be in conversation with me. And they're doing so much because this will be on C-SPAN. If you can't get there, Andrea, this will be broadcast on Book TV on C-SPAN.
Excellent. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's good to know so that if anybody, like you said, if I can't get there, I can watch it on C-SPAN. That is so good to know. And it's so good, right. And it's so good to know that you're going to be here. Like you said, like, as you said, you're kicking off your tour here in Detroit, and as a native Detroiter, I want to thank you for doing it that way because I appreciate your presence and I appreciate the story that you're bringing to the city, and I thank you for being my guest today on Michigan Literary Network Radio.
Thank you, Andrea. It's always a pleasure. Anytime you want me, you just give a call.
All right, I will.
Well, I'll
thank
call
you.
So
you. yeah, you can do that too. Okay, enjoy the rest of your night, Mr. Boyd.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And that is it for this edition of Michigan Literary Network Radio. I want to thank Herb Boyd again for being on the air with me. As we mentioned, you can check him out at the Museum of African American History in Detroit this Saturday, June 10th at 2 p.m. to hear his discussion about his book, Detroit Black, A People's History of Determination. And if you can't make it there, you can watch it on C-SPAN. If you want to know more about the book, to purchase it and all of that, you can get the information off of the book's Facebook page, Detroit, Black Detroit, A People's History of Determination. And that's it for this edition of Michigan Literary Network Radio. Remember to stay connected with Michigan's literary community through the Michigan Literary Network and Motown Writers Network at www.motownwriters.com. And you can find us on Facebook. And be sure to tune in to Michigan Literary Network Radio right here on blogtalkradio.com next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. to hear more literary good stuff with my guest, Tamika Kane. This has been Andrea Daniel for Michigan Literary Network Radio. Thank you all out there for listening. I really do appreciate you being there. Have a good rest of your night. Have a good rest of your week. And until next week, live a good story. And if you are so inclined, write about it. Bye-bye.